Hello, I'm Richard Heathen for Liberty Machine News. Today I'm joined with radio host, independent journalist, James Corbett. He's a frequent guest on Russia Today and has been on numerous alternative media shows, including The Alex Jones Show. How are you doing today, James?
I'm doing pretty good. I can tell everyone it's the 21st of December 2012 here in Japan, and so far the world has not ended.
Oh, that's right. Well, you're excellent. We so no sliding effect of burning melting mountains and
not yet. It's the day's still young, so we'll see.
All right. Well, we don't have much time with you today, so we'll jump in. Jump right in. Today I want to talk to you about the ongoing conflict in Syria, and I just want to start off, get the ball rolling. What role do you think Western military and intelligence agencies playing in supporting the rebels in Syria?
Well, we know, for example, it came out earlier this year that the CIA has in fact already been in Syria for some time, coordinating efforts with various rebel groups on the ground. So we know that this is, I mean, we know that Obama signed this, the order for the CIA to go in. So we already know to a certain extent that intelligence agencies are on the ground. I don't think anyone really doubted that, but at any rate, we have it in black and white, even in the paper of record, the New York Times. I think we'd have to be also naive to think that there aren't other intelligence units and special forces that have moved in, and people might be able to cast their mind back to Libya, where, for example, British special forces were kidnapped for a brief period of time, and of course Britain had to admit, oh yes, our special forces are on the ground there. So we haven't seen a similar incident to that yet in Syria, but I think we'd have to be naive to think that there aren't special forces of various countries that are already involved actively in what's going on the ground there. And of course, we also know that the U.S. has been actively involved in training some of the rebel forces in Turkey and in Jordan, where they've had military presence along the border with Syria for some time. So we know that there's a pincher movement to try to squeeze Assad from both sides, and that's been going on for a long time too. So it's difficult, of course, in the fog of war and from our limited perspective, to be able to say definitively what intelligence assets are where and what they're doing at any particular moment. But we do know that they are there and that they're influencing what's happening in Syria.
What do you make of the hype in Western media regarding the threat of Assad using chemical weapons on the population there? Do you think there's any basis to that whatsoever, or do you think it's just completely more lies and propaganda and distortion from the mainstream corporate horror media?
Well, that's a loaded question, but I do appreciate it because I think it puts it in the right perspective. I think it's quite obvious we have to. I mean, anyone, even people who want to believe this type of propaganda, would have to raise a skeptical flag over this, especially since what we saw in the run-up to the Iraq War with the threat of chemical weapons and weapons of mass destruction that turned out to not even exist. In this case with Syria, we do know that the Syrian government does have chemical weapons. This is not really disputed. This is an established fact. But suddenly, these reports are coming out that he's getting ready to use them, that there is some unnamed and unspecified difference in the way that they're aligning their chemical weapon stockpiles that indicates they're preparing them, and all they need is an order from Assad. And of course, these reports started coming out a few weeks ago in earnest, and all of these reports sourced back to unnamed U.S. officials. So I think we can trust those reports as far as we can throw them, and since they're not sourced to anyone in particular, we can't throw them at all. And this is just another example, I think, of the devolution of media reporting on issues like this. I mean, I don't think they could have gotten away with reporting that flimsy and flaccid a few decades ago. And it's quite a sign of their estimation of the public's intelligence that they'll ask the entire public to believe, simply because an unnamed U.S. official says so, that some unnamed and unspecified difference in the way the chemical weapons stockpiles are being positioned or maneuvered or whatever they're claiming is happening is somehow indicative of a looming threat of Assad going full-on, totally insane and suicidal, and threatening to use chemical weapons against his population, despite the fact that the foreign minister and Assad himself has repeatedly said, dozens of times now, on the record, that they will not use chemical weapons on their own citizens. But apparently, that doesn't matter to the mainstream media outlets, which didn't bother to report this foreign minister's rejection of that claim. They only bothered to report the unnamed U.S. officials that supposedly want you to believe that Assad is preparing to use these weapons.
Now, I've heard reported in the alternative media, and this could be equally as wrong, but that the rebels are the ones with the chemical who have weapons and have some form of chemical weapons and are planning to and have been caught using them on the ground. But that could just be baseless accusations.
Well, we do know that there was this video that came out a few weeks ago that was claiming to be, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, from a Sunni sect, obviously part of the so-called rebel opposition, that was at least claiming that they had chemical weapons. They did show some of the supposed chemicals that they were working with, and they did, on the video, actually test it out on a lab rabbit who died in a rather disturbing way, and then they said something to the effect of, and now we're coming for you, you Shiite scum, with these chemical weapons, you will die. And again, the provenance of that video, and who made it, and whether this was actually chemical weapons or what they were doing, is still, I think, up in the air, but at the very least, we have on record some group claiming to be part of the rebel opposition that was claiming to use chemical weapons and claiming to have them, which is more than really the Syrian government has ever done, because it's never threatened to use its chemical weapons and has in fact repeatedly said that it won't.
Well, it's interesting because these are supposedly the good guys. These are the rebels. These are the rebels. They are the Rebel Alliance. You know, pew pew, Star Wars. You know, fighting the tyranny. But it's interesting because they're the ones threatening. But like you said, you don't know if that's actual, the veracity of that or not. But on the topic of the rebels, I'd like to get into who exactly are the rebels. Most reports I've seen actually say that they're Al Qaeda fighters from Iraq and Libya, Iraq, Afghanistan, and now Libya. I thought these groups are supposed to be the enemies at one second, and the next second they're our allies. You want to
elaborate on that? So the constitution of the rebel groups is it's certainly based on sectarian divisions within Islam itself. So for people who don't know, the demographics of Syria is that it's about 80% or 74% Sunni, whereas 13% of the population are Shia and 10% are Christian. So within that Shia grouping, there's different divisions, including Alawites, which is a certain sect of Shia Islam, which is the sect that that Assad comes from. So what you've had in Syria for decades now is a situation where the minority group has been ruling the country. And because of that, you've had a kind of strange balance of power going on in Syria. Of course, there's been oppression, and it's been a pretty horrible regime in a lot of respects. But at any rate, they could never go too far towards trying to act out against the Sunnis, because of course, being a majority, it would be almost unenforceable. So there's been a kind of a strange balance of power that has held sway in Syria for a long time, but that we see that being upset now, and the Sunni majority is now rebelling against the Shia minority, which has been in power for so long. And this Sunni majority is a large part of what makes up this rebel opposition. But what we see is the fighters that are coming in, that are being smuggled in basically through Iraq, are coming from places like Saudi Arabia and other places where they have Wahhabi Sunnists and others who are basically seeing this as a type of Islamic, I guess, civil war or sectarian strife. And so this is drawing in people from all across the globe who are interested in this type of fight, and including, of course, people who have been specifically linked up with groups that have even boasted at times of being involved in, for example, the Iraqi opposition to American forces back when they were fighting that particular battle. So these are some of the very same characters that the U.S. has been nominally against, but now they are supporting because, again, it's being aimed against a government that they want to see toppled. So it is certainly making some strange bedfellows, and yes, this does track back to the same types of groups that supposedly the entire war on terror was formed in order to eradicate. And now we have even such places as the Council on Foreign Relations, we have people writing editorials on the CFR homepage saying, yeah, well, Al-Qaeda might actually be a good thing every now and then, and we kind of need them in this battle. And it's a bizarre thing to behold, but it's right there in black and white.
Yeah, I remember it was a few months ago I seen a article from, I can't remember who the author was, but it was a CFR article and basically stating that, well, we need to get more involved in the Syrian conflict and, you know, help these people more for because
just,
I don't really...
Just to document that for the listeners, it's Ed Hussein, and he wrote an article called Al-Qaeda's Specter in Syria that's on CFR.org right now.
Oh, well, touche. I'm interested, what do you think the global geopolitical strategy is of the West, or of NATO, of the United States? Because I remember there was a clip a few, like last year and a half ago, I think it was General Wesley Clark, he's talking about how they plan to invade numerous nations, and this was told by the Bush administration before even the Iraq war.
That's right. For people who haven't seen the clip, basically he lists five, I believe it's five nations that he on the chopping block for what's next after Iraq. And he was quite shocked at this. This was back during the Bush neocon cabal days. And a lot of people have made something out of this. Personally, I'm a bit skeptical about this Wesley Clark clip because, again, some of the countries that he names, and I don't remember off the top of my head what the five countries are, and that's
I think one, there was Libya, Syria, I think Somalia was mentioned as well.
Could have been. Well, whatever it was, I know there were countries on that list that have not been attacked, that aren't even on the geopolitical board yet, and this is already, what, 6 or 7 years after he supposedly heard this battle plan, so I'm quite skeptical as to whether this is the plan that they're following. But at any rate, there is, I think it is quite obvious that where this is all trending, and this is, of course, Syria having been an important ally of Iran for some time, I have always posited that getting rid of the Assad government and trying to put in perhaps a Sunni to balance the Shias in Iran has been a part of the geopolitical strategy of what's going on here. And ultimately, I think even Iran itself has to be seen as just another domino towards what is going to be the long-run geopolitical fight, which is sort of the battle between the NATO forces and China and Russia, and of course Iran being a key linchpin for them in the Middle East region.
See, I was actually just going to ask you that. Ask you what you think the interested parties are behind the scenes. Is that so? You think that am I understanding you correctly? Where you say you think that the purpose of this is to muscle out China and Russia. So is this like a proxy war then?
I think we have to take a look at it in that regard. I can't imagine that Syria itself is of such pressing geopolitical importance to the NATO powers. It does have some resources, it does have some oil and gas, and there are reasons, I think, to try to put their fingers in that pie. But it's certainly not worth this protracted battle and spending all their political capital on trying to overcome this one government. I think there has to be a bigger agenda behind it. And I think Syria destabilization has to be seen in the context of the next domino towards unseating Iran, which in the vacuum that was created after the invasion of Iraq really was positioned to become the dominant player in the region. That was what the Iran-Iraq war was about in the 1980s, was who was going to be that dominant player. And that's why, of course, America was supporting Iraq so heavily in the 1980s as part of this balance of power. Because once again, a house divided cannot stand. The Sunnis and Shias have been battling for control over the Middle East for a long time. America has traditionally been on the side of the Sunnis, including, of course, their Wahhabist friends in Saudi Arabia, which was a regime that was basically created by the Brits, etc., etc. This goes far back, and it's important also to note that Syria itself is, again, just lines on a map that was drawn by the Brits and the French after World War II, and is not really... I mean, it's a hodgepodge of different sects and different divisions. There's Kurds in there as well. Of course, the Kurdish factor is another part in all of this. So it's important to note that this isn't really a country in the sense that we would think of some of the longer standing countries. And they're just, again, trying to redraw some lines on a map in order to better suit their geopolitical interests, which, again, I think has to be seen in the long term towards the destabilization of Iran and then as a way of getting a firmer foothold over the Middle East region in general and muscling out Russia and China.
So what do you think the potential is for this to blow up into a wider, even global conflict, like a larger conflict and potentially even a world war? What do you think the probability is of that?
Unfortunately, it's a very real possibility, and I don't know if I envision that in the near term, but I think that we, in the future, historians of the future may be able to look back at these types of incidents as the groundwork for what would become that larger war. And again, I think we can see this in the growing recalcitrance of Russia and China on issues like this. And of course, there's been a lot in the press in recent days about Russia and how that now they're abandoning the Assad regime and they're backtracking. And the Western media is trying to make something more of this than what it is, I think. But it does show that Russia and China have very much been the focus on the international side of this conflict. And the understanding is that nothing's going to happen in Syria without Russia and China going along with it, at least tacitly. And under Putin, that's looking less and less likely as Putin is trying to consolidate his power and now to expand it in a Eurasian Union. So I think that when Mitt Romney was talking about China having to devalue its currency on day one, or we'd treat them as pariahs and Russia is the biggest geopolitical threat to America, I think that that actually was not just crazy talk, it was crazy talk, but I think it actually represents a significant faction in the U.S. Neocon cabal, which is still there behind the scenes and still, you know, plotting to get into power in various ways. And I think that really does represent a certain strategy that's on the table to try to basically pit this as a war of civilizations, not a war of civilizations. That's the Islamic Christian nonsense that we've been fed.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I guess the Cold War stage two is what we're in right now. And of course, with any Cold War, there's the possibility that it could spill over into a hot war. Again, I don't see that as a near-term possibility because, again, right now, China, for example, even with its growing military might and its growing military expenditures, is nowhere near capable of defending itself against a sustained American attack or NATO attack. But we're getting to the point where we can see that table turning, and this is a significant time in the world geopolitical situation for that alone. I think we can see this as a turning point.
What do you think Russia and China's strategy is then? Like, how are they playing?
I think honestly, of course, with 9/11, which was of course the excuse to go much further into the Middle East and start trying to redraw the map. I think Russia and China was reading the tea leaves right then and knew that there was no possibility of any type of military confrontation with America over its military agenda there in the Middle East. So I think that their strategy for many, many years now has been to sort of sit back and to allow the U.S. to get itself mired deeper and deeper in the region. And meanwhile, for example, specifically, China has been fostering alliances with various governments to acquire resources. We see that very specifically in Africa. We've also seen that happening in places like Syria and Iran and Pakistan, even, where traditionally they've been enemies, but they've actually been driven into each other's arms to some extent by U.S. aggression, which is, I think, part of the strategy that China and Russia are using. And of course, people point to Chinese military strategy as being one of, it's too early to tell if the French Revolution was successful. They don't think in terms of days or months or years. They think not even in terms of centuries, perhaps in terms of millennia. And that is the kind of long game that I think is at play right now. And of course, that doesn't feed into a 24/7 news cycle very well for people who are waiting for what's the next thing that's going to happen, what's the next thing. I think it's more a question of trying to build up this whole other system, and that's something that's perhaps a generational project. And at some point, I think the Americans will probably, the NATO allies will have to be the aggressors against Russia and China. I can't imagine it being the other way around, because I think Russia and China are happy to sit there building up their alliances behind the scenes and letting the U.S. get further and further, you know, bogged down in places like Syria.
How do you think this plays out I can't try and explain this, but basically you have the globalists in America and the westernized nations. Are China and Russia dedicated to globalism and one world government and UN? Or are they more vying for independence? What's the dynamic there?
I think they are very much globalists at heart. I think every government, every regime is lusting after power, and I think world domination is in the hearts of all the people who seek to dominate over other people. But certainly not through the UN model. I think the United Nations model is very much seen as being that tool of the NATO allies to a large extent that rubber stamp things like the bombing of Iraq. Or actually, no, they didn't rubber stamp that particular invasion. But of course, that was where that's where they tried to make their case in the first place. Because again, that's the stamp of legitimacy. But it's certainly not the organization I think that Russia and China are looking towards as the basis for their ploy at world government, at globalization. And again, it's a question of even if at the top of these regimes, if they're really truly opposed to what's going on, or if they just want a bigger share of the pie of what's going to become the regional governments that feed into the world government. Again, I think there's a lot going on behind the scenes that we just do not have access to be able to say definitively. But certainly, I don't think that they're fundamentally opposed to the idea of world government or regional governments or that type of system. It's just the type of regional governments they want to bring in and who's going to be, you know, leading them. And Putin, for example, quite specifically, has been talking about a Eurasian Union for years now. And that's what people are saying. At any rate, pundits are speculating that's going to be the focus of his new term as president.
So do you think this is could all just be posturing then to get a greater position of power in the overall new world order? Or do you think that it will, in order for NATO to get their new world order, that they will have to be a hot third world war?
I think in order for NATO to achieve what it wants to achieve, it probably would involve military confrontation at some point. I can't imagine that wouldn't actually turn into confrontation. And again, I'm not sure it's just posturing per se, but I think that there may be a difference in kind between the types of world government that are on the table. And certainly if we look at least the past actions of players like China, which is a growing economic and military power, still in its infancy, I would say, in that regard, but a growing power nonetheless, has still not attacked another nation in defense of its interests. It tends to work by trying to build up alliances with governments, not even alliances per se, but just sort of almost like business deals with other governments, that they'll provide them with infrastructure investments in return for access to resources. And that's, for example, the paradigm that's holding sway in Africa right now, and that's why China has so much access to resources in Africa. And as opposed to, of course, the NATO model, which is to go on in and support opposition groups, overturn governments, put in puppet dictators, and then to use that as the way to get the access. So I think there is a competing model for how such a government might be structured. And if you want to play that game, I suppose there could even be a case to be made. Well, wouldn't the sort of let's cooperate and use
alliances, make a deal,
wouldn't that be a better deal than you know, having people the boot on the face?
Well,
I don't want to get into that game because fundamentally I'm a voluntarist and I don't think there should be
governments
at all.
I agree. I'm a anarchist or voluntarist. Practically speaking, I'm a libertarian, but yeah, philosophically, I'm a voluntarist. But no, it's interesting. So, do you think the Russian and Chinese they don't particularly like the UN model? A huge part of the UN model is Agenda 21 and sustainable development. How are they buying into that model at all, or are they kind of just not dealing with it, not having it?
If there's any sign that China cares at all about things like Kyoto and greenhouse gases, etc., and things like that, which are a lot of the basis for these types of sustainable, you know, rhetoric that we're hearing in the Western countries, if there's any sign of that, I haven't seen it. And I don't think they're going to buy into it at all. I think that's very much meant for domestic consumption in the NATO countries. And unfortunately, so many people have bought into it. But one of the things that undermines all that is, even if it were true, and even if carbon dioxide really was the most poisonous thing we could ever possibly, you know, think of, the point is still that China is an incredibly vast and growing industrial power that is pumping out way more greenhouse gases at a faster and faster rate of acceleration than is happening in any Western country, and yet it's absolutely not putting any caps or any taxes or anything on its emissions, and never will, conceivably. I mean, it's just not on the political agenda. So again, that just goes to expose that fraud. And I think it's absolutely a fraud that's being perpetrated more in the Western world than it is being even considered in places like China and Russia.
Well, here's what I think. It seems like the whole sustainable development thing is like a crutch to bring, like, that's why the more conspiratorial mind I have makes me think that there is some sort of brewing conflict that's meant to happen, because, like, the sustainable development thing is like to me, it's like a crutch. It's like an anchor on the West. It anchors our ability to create our economy, all things that make a strong civilization, and yet Russia and China aren't part of that. So it seems like it's being kind of a anchor to bring us down, and, you know, and they're not following it. So it really makes me wonder if this is some sort of mechanism for, you know, evening out the odds, so we can have a third world war that would be fair, or if it's just a way to kind of bring us down to their level, so we wouldn't have. So if there was the possibility of a third. Or I don't want to say third world war, because that sounds so cliche, but a broader global conflict, that it'd be like, well, we can't have that, so we'll work together. Do you understand what I'm trying to say?
I think I do, and I think that is actually a fruitful way of looking at it. I think that we can't understand this agenda of sustainability, or whatever they want to call it, as anything other than an attempt to hobble the ability of the industrialized developed nations to actually function properly. And if we look at that geopolitically in terms of these conflicts, then yes, I mean, I do think of that as some sort of basically crippling of industry and the ability to actually create some sort of military might behind what has traditionally been the military might of the Western nations. So I could see that absolutely, as you say, as some sort of, I guess, veiled or long-term attempt to try to even out the odds in some way, or at least to create the impression, the perception that there has been some sort of leveling out of the playing field. Of course, it is generally dealing with perceptions when we talk about things like this rather than the reality. But yeah, I see what you're saying, and I think that is something that we should at least be taking into account.
Well, also, when a nation's in poverty, it's more likely to rally, I think, at least more likely to rally behind their leaders in a warlike attempt. Because Agenda 21 is very, and the whole state's sustainable development agenda is, in my mind, totalitarian and not, and does not breed. It's not liberty based at all. It's based on collectivism. So once you have that, it's more. And when you have a more totalitarian state, people are more likely to rally around leaders, I would say.
Well, I would say that it bifurcates the population more. There's going to be probably a significant majority, but a certain section of that public that will rally around the flag or the leader or whatever they're told to, but there will be that dissenting minority.
And well, of course.
Of course, the more totalitarian it gets, the more brutally they'll deal with that dissenting minority. And of course, this creates the whole framework for people to basically dehumanize those people who wouldn't want to go along with this collectivist agenda, because you are now an enemy of the Earth, so you have to be dealt with. And it's at this point, it's still somewhat removed from that level of discourse, but I mean it's not difficult to see how we can get from here to there with the type of discourse that they're already and have been trying to foster and inculcate, for example, with the global warming myth for the last couple of decades.
Well, I think the global warming myth is starting to fade, and they're just using like a whole, like, overpopulation, basically every environmental problem, real or fabricated, over the last 50 years, they're just balling it up onto one big problem and say we have to deal with it all at once. We don't have much more time with you, do I?
I'm going to have to get ready for my radio show, so I have about 10 more minutes.
All right, well, just get back more laser back on focus. Do you actually think an eventual full-blown invasion of Syria is in the cards?
Personally, I don't see how that would play out, at least not at this point. I can't imagine getting from here to there, especially because Syria specifically for the last several years has been concertedly building up its anti-aircraft defenses to the point where it's now the fifth most capable anti-aircraft defense nation in the world, with a lot of support from Russia in that, obviously. And I just don't see that there's any possibility of really maintaining a no-fly zone or anything like that, which has been used, of course, to facilitate the bombing of Iraq and Libya and other places. So I don't see, I can't envision how they would get to that point, really. I don't think they want to put in the full-scale military investment that would be required. I mean, it would be a significant force that would be required for an invasion in that sense. I think the U.S. is happy to keep it destabilized and to keep using the proxy forces, even if it's not necessarily going to overturn Assad anytime soon, or even if it never overturns Assad. At any rate, certainly Assad is pretty much taken out of the picture, and the Syrian government has been soundly destabilized so that it keeps it in that state of chaos, which I think is part of what this is ultimately about anyway. As long as you can keep that chaos going, obviously this is not going to be a viable partner for Iran, and it's going to further isolate the Iranian government.
Fair, I see what you're saying. You basically, yeah, so they basically want to isolate Iran and stop Syria from being a potential ally.
Pretty much.
Well, do you think people in Canada and abroad are they waking up to the whole war on terror fraud to the point where if there is some sort of conflict in Syria The government won't feel comfortable just walking in there with their military.
Right. Okay. Well, I'd like to be able to say that I think that there's been a widespread revolution in understanding. I'm not sure how widespread it is. I think there are certainly more people who are quizzical about this than there were, say, 10 years ago. And there's a lot more information about some of the players, and I think there's a growing awareness of what's happening in the Middle East, and we're starting to get to the point where there's a more general understanding of the fact that there are, at the very least, it's starting to differentiate some of the groups, which at the very least goes some way towards demythologizing sort of the Middle East as being some, you know, some total monolithic entity that is just some place out there that we can go and bomb, and they're all terrorists, and no one has to care.
They're all Muslims.
You're right.
Yeah, they're
exactly,
all Muslims.
Exactly. It complicates that a little bit, and people are at least starting to sort of get a little bit better understanding of what the region is and who some of the players are and the way some of the alliances are, which, at the very least, makes the propagandist job a little bit harder. So I guess that's an improvement. Certainly, we see that the people who deeply understand what's going on, and the fact that, you know, the U.S. is now supporting Al-Qaeda and all of the hypocrisy and all of this and the fact that it's a complete fraud, I'd say that is growing, and there are more people who are waking up to this. And, of course, this is exactly what the alternative media is doing at this particular time, is creating the space for that awareness, if nothing else, and the space to question. Because as we've seen really a polarization of the media. The mainstream media has become ever more ridiculous in its reporting on these types of things, and is culminating in things like the Syrian chemical weapons fraud, which is taking place right now based on unnamed U.S. officials, which, again, I say, I don't think they would have gotten away with reporting like that a few decades ago, back when there was no significant underground alternative media movement like there is today. And I think that's because people are basically being polarized into the people who still believe and watch the MSM and the people who don't. And so the MSM has to become even more of a caricature and even more of a mouthpiece for the establishment. So I think that's the direction we can see things going. And the most hopeful sign of all is that the MSM continues to bleed viewers left, right, and center, and is, we've seen for a long time now, the numbers are trending towards where the internet is becoming the main source of news for more and more people. So that is a positive sign, because at the very least, it gives people the possibility to find out a more nuanced approach on all of this.
All right, one last question before I let you go. How do you think Canadians and people around the world can, like, support the Syrian people in not having our governments go in and bomb them? And not just Syrian government, not just the Syrian people, but everyone. Like, there's so many people who just don't want us to go abroad and bomb people. And I think that's not an unreasonable thing. How do you suggest we work to stop our governments from going and bombing brown people, or not just brown people, any kind of people?
Yes. Well, that's really the question. And you're exactly right. It's not simply about what we can do about Syria, because, again, the Syria is Syrian, and it has to be an answer that comes from Syria. As a Canadian who lives in Japan, but as a Canadian, the only moral responsibility I can really take for myself is what the Canadian government is doing in my name. And that's something that each person has to think about in terms of their own, wherever they happen to be living in this world, what their own government is doing and what they can do against that. And whether it be raising awareness of what's going on, whether it's trying to change the political discourse, whether it's trying to engage with the political system, if there are still statists out there that believe that the political system can be changed, if there are people who want to spread the understanding that government itself is the problem, not the solution. Whatever that is, I hope people will understand that their responsibility is about what's being done in their arbitrary geographical, you know, the point of the map, and that as a Canadian, I'm responsible for the Canadian bombs that were dropped on Libya. Not personally, obviously, but that is the mindset we need to have to understand that there is moral responsibility to what is happening in the world. And unless we actually confront that and we absolutely reject and denounce what is being done in our names, then we will never make any progress, because, again, it can always be shunted off into something that's happening in some distant land.
You know, I think you make an excellent point. Those bombs, those children that are being killed, they're like, I'm sure you're familiar with the child with the video of the child in Libya. I think it was a 3-year-old girl who had her lower mandible or jaw blown off, and that's being done in our name. Like, I think we need to own that. We need people to look at that, and that's why I think the work you do is great. You're amazing on foreign policy, man. Keep up the great work. Like, we need people to like look at that and say that's what your taxpayer, that's what your tax dollars are going to. That's being done in your name. That's done on your behalf. I think you bring up an excellent point. But thanks, James. I'm going to let you go. I know you got a radio show to prepare for. Thank you so much for your time. It's always great to talk to you, man.
Thank you for the questions. I appreciate your insights, too, and keep up the great work. And once again, I'll post this on my website, so let people know what your address is.
My website is libertymachine.org, and my YouTube is youtube.com/deathmetalpatriot.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.